From the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, this is a Guy's Take episode. But inflation is good for the economy, we're told. Inflation produces economic growth. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a load of shit. So, we are diving into... I hope you guys are doing good today, because I had a really, really late night last night. If you listen to Deflation and Liberty Part 2, I was up until about midnight recording, and then still had a couple things to take care of. I was up much later than I should have been. Very, very busy week, but it's felt good. I got a lot done. It was a happy, busy week, not a bad, busy week. So I'm feeling pretty good. We're at the end of the week here. I'm about to have a very fun weekend getaway with the wife. And yeah, so we're going to talk a little bit specifically. We'll do a lot of referencing to her, Guido Holzman's piece that we just covered on the show. So Deflation and Liberty. I'll probably be dropping some references to Simon Lutz's piece on the Keynesian errors of time and demand, because those are critically important to this entire discussion. Like, when we talk about inflation, really the definition we're talking about is the inflation of the money supply. That's like the core, like, technical definition, but we're also talking about the increase in the price level, which is typically the consequence. The price level inflation is a consequence of the money supply inflation. So it gets a little bit confusing sometimes when you're trying to break down to the actual specifics, but I'll try to make sure I'm clarifying which one I'm talking about, because we have the exact same thing in deflation, an actual lowering of the money supply versus a lowering of the price level. And now when we're talking about, like, credit deflation, like when we have a credit crisis, deflation is legitimately the lowering of the money supply, where money starts disappearing from the economy because people are defaulting on their debts. But in the context of Bitcoin, even though it has a lot of the same effects kind of in an inflationary currency environment, like if you have a deflationary, quote unquote, one where the price level of the monetary good is continuing to increase in value, and therefore all the prices of all the goods are decreasing, well, then you actually create a lot of the effects and a lot of the same pressures that credit deflation causes, or deflation in the money supply, but just not to the extreme and in a very different way, because the credit deflation is actually correcting an imbalance, whereas the price level deflation is actually happening because of growth. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that in a bit. And I haven't even introduced the show. Welcome. Welcome. This is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. That's me, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and probably anybody else on the planet. And today's show is going to be all about inflation and deflation, basically crushing the myths of inflation, and also it will be a pseudo follow-up, because this is kind of what we've been reading, obviously, in the last 2 days, a follow-up for Deflation and Liberty by her, Guido Holzman. But if you have not listened to that, I will be referencing it, but I'll mostly be re-explaining a lot of the ideas. So it's not super necessary that you listen to it, but I highly, highly recommend it, because it's a really, really good piece, and it will certainly make this give you a much better foundation for this conversation. So the first thing, we'll actually hit Holzman's kind of foundation for starting his entire piece, and something that he kind of referred back to a number of times, is that a change in the supply of money does not have any real consequences, just as the nature of the change. Like, the example he gave is, if all prices were cut by 50% tomorrow, there would be no changes in production process. there would be no changes in, like, we don't have any less machines, like any fewer machines. We don't have any less production capacity. We don't have any fewer resources, nothing. Like, and we've not even lost the ability to profit, because profit is not the ability to, you know, make back a certain nominal amount of money, like a certain, like, specific number. It's the fact that it's the difference between what you sell and what your costs are. So, like, you might have to sell a product for half the price, but you're also buying all your factors of production at half the price. So it's no different. There has been no fundamental economic or physical change. Everything is exactly the same. We could wake up and you could just knock a zero off of everything and pretty much everything would still work, right? We just work under a completely different set of prices. So that's really important to start from, is that decreasing or increasing the money supply is just only has redistribution effects. It does not change the nature of the economy and the resources and machines and factors of production that are available. It shifts resources from group A to group B. And the question is, who is group A and group B in each of these situations? If we're talking about inflation or deflation or taxes or whatever it is. Basically, everything that the government does is just redistributing resources from the people who actually made it to the people they think deserve it, and then paying themselves enormous amounts of money for deciding who is important enough to deserve all the money. And it's all managed through politics, which we all know is a very morally sound and high standard form of communication. So regardless, the key takeaway is just that the manipulation or changes in the supply of money only has redistributive effects. All right, let's start by talking about how great inflation is. So inflation is, when we talk about inflation, there's kind of a couple of different things that we mean. One, obviously, is price level inflation. Inflation is what you see in housing prices, in education prices, healthcare prices, stock prices, like all of these, everything that's like an asset or has a lot of money being pushed into the industry, all of these things have incredible amounts of inflation. And it typically affects assets far faster than it affects like consumer products and like things like that. But it does obviously happen kind of across the board. But the reason we actually have inflation is the increase in the money supply. So that's inflation in the price level, and it happens because of an increase in the supply of money available. And that mostly happens in our economy because of the fractional reserve system, because of the creation of new debts. What happens is banks are essentially, this is a gross oversimplification of it, but what actually is occurring when you look at the grand picture of things is that when you have $100 in the bank, the entire banking system ends up loaning almost $900 or $1,000 backed by your $100. And that's just kind of like a general overview. That doesn't account for the fact that they leverage to far, far more insane degrees with other sorts of types of loans and credit issuance and stuff. And in that situation, when we're just talking about the fractional reserve, we're ignoring the fact that the Federal Reserve can just issue loans out of thin air. There's no reserve. There's no nothing. They can just issue credit to banks and large financial institutions all day. And they do this with the bailouts. That's what QE, quantitative easing. That's what all this stuff is. It's just dumping new money. And again, no change in the production process or how many goods we have, how much time we have available to us, how many machines we have working. None of that changes. This is just a huge flood of new cheap money to certain very specific institutions and people in the economy. So we're told The one benefit that you hear all the time is that economic growth can't happen. It promotes economic growth to increase the money supply, and that it encourages investment because otherwise people would hold on to their savings. They wouldn't spend money, and of course it encourages spending, which is the supposed argument of it increases in economic growth. And really, that's kind of the bulk of it. Everything else is just like a consequence of that. Because you think about it, like, we're just increasing the price of money. So you just have to go down this list of like, oh, all these great things happen when stuff gets more expensive. They argue that asset prices going up, stock prices and stuff going up is good. And it's only good for the wealthy. It's not good for the poor. It's good for the people who own the assets. But we're going to talk about why all of this stuff is wrong. First, we know, no, it doesn't. It does not increase economic growth, whatever. It is a change in the money supply. It moves value from one set of people to another set of people. And there's a very important question as to who is losing value and who is gaining value. In inflation, and this is something that I don't think Herg Guido Holzman in the previous thing, Deflation and Liberty, he doesn't quite hit this aspect as much as I would think he would. And that's the key thing that I always feel like the redistribution is really happening between, even though there are a lot of other players and stuff, is just between savers and debtors. And people who have debt and people who have savings. That's what's being shifted. When in an inflationary economy where the money supply is being inflated, it is being taken away from, the value is being confiscated from the people who have savings. And it is being transferred to the people who are taking on debts. So we know people are can be conditioned, right? Like, people are creatures of habit and creatures of social order. And, you know, if you do the ring the bell experiment with the dog and make them salivate, you can do that very same thing with humans. Like, we respond to incentives. Incentives matter massively. So stop and think about what it means for inflation to be costing savers at the direct benefit, I guess you could say indirect, I don't know, at the benefit of debtors. What's happening is the value of the people who have already produced resources, the ones who are responsible for all of the resources that we currently now live off of, is being taken. It is stolen from the savers to benefit the people who are going into debt. The debtors being those who are then consuming and using up all of these resources and choosing not to produce them back in return. Maybe they do, but they haven't done it yet. They're taking the resources out of the economy, making the economy poorer, and we're promising them, we're essentially weighing, we're hooking a giant counterparty risk on the entire economy that we have just now exhausted all of our resources, or the however much is given to debtors. We've given them all these resources with the counterparty risk and trusting that they will pay it back. We are disincentivizing the people who have actually made resources available. We are punishing those people and rewarding the people who merely consume. And in deflation, you're seeing the opposite. The value is shifted from the debtors to the savers. It's almost kind of like and again, we're talking really about price deflation here. In the money supply issue, deflation is actually just a consequence. The price level deflation is a consequence of people defaulting. So like Herrigita Holzman talked about, is that you have these quote-unquote deflationary spirals that happen when debt gets out of control, because this loan gets defaulted on, and then the institution that's holding all these defaulting loans gets defaulted on, and then whoever gave them the loan, et cetera, it just goes up the tree, and you have this huge, one catalyst event or something, and then this huge domino effect of just default, and then money is vanishing from the economy. Not actual money, not like cash money or gold or anything like that, But all the money substitutes, the dollars in everyone's bank accounts that they think is there, and all the value of their stocks and their asset prices, which they think is real money, but is not real money. It's all propped up on that counterparty risk that we're talking about. If those debtors cannot pay, if those people with debts can't pay their resources back, cannot produce the same level of resources, well, then all that value is actually frivolous. All that value is entirely dependent on a bunch of promises. But this is what makes Bitcoin a little bit different, because Bitcoin's money supply doesn't shrink. It's just such a scarce asset that its price goes up. So you're expecting consistent or you have expected price level deflation to occur. And what's interesting there, particularly when we've already met, like after we go through the S curve of Bitcoin adoption and we've reached market saturation, you have to remember exactly why price levels would go down. Because people would say it's like, oh, deflation in that context with sound money would stop economic growth, and you know, people would hold on to just their money, et cetera, et cetera. But at that point, it doesn't make any sense, because we're not talking about the money supply hasn't shrunk. The money supply is stable, which means the only way for nominal prices to fall is if the economy grew. So not only is it not anti-economic growth, it's a measure of the consequences of economic growth that has already happened. It happens specifically because the economy has now more resources and higher productivity, so the value of other goods in relation, like, you know, if somebody is producing 100 shirts an hour, and well, then, you know, shirts have a certain degree of scarcity and difficulty to obtain and certain degree of cost. But if someone can use those exact same resources and start producing 10,000 shirts an hour, well, it's a whole lot easier to own a shirt. Shirts become far greater in supply and less, each individual shirt becomes less valuable because it's no longer difficult to just make a shirt. So when you're talking about deflation in the price level, after we have market saturation of sound money, it is explicitly because of economic growth. So not only does it not deter economic growth, it is the measure of economic growth. It's like a real GDP as opposed to the joke that is GDP trying to actually measure economic growth. You would just be able to measure it in, if you had a stable monetary market, you would just measure it in the price declines of typical goods. Like, it would be reverse CPI, and we'd be measuring how much the economy grew and how much more efficient it became and how much more we are able to produce at aggregate. So again, inflation is simply adjusting value and resources to those who are going into debt, which makes perfect sense as to why all the banking institutions and the government hail it as a savior of the economy, because of course they think themselves as the most important things in the economy. The government thinks as long as we have the Department of Education, there is education. They equate themselves and their own greed and their own profit and their own political power as that of the nation. It's a very weird religious thing. And so in doing so, it makes perfect sense that they would hate the constraints on only being able to borrow a certain amount of money. Anybody would, particularly if they believe themselves to be, you know, saviors of the world. Obviously, I have to have unlimited resources at my disposal. And everybody hates constraints. You know, like, nobody likes to run out of resources. Obviously, our goals and our dreams are always way bigger than what resources we have available to us. It's the natural state of things. And so it makes perfect sense that they would absolutely promote it as hard as they can, because they profit off of it directly and massively. Like, it makes them the most powerful institution in the world. How would you do, what other possible incentive could be as powerful as that? Is that, holy crap, if I just tell people this and they believe me, I am the most powerful institution on the planet. End of story, or at least in the country. the U.S. government gets the benefit of having the world reserve currency, and that power gets to extend outside. But so we have all these like really silly justifications for inflation. One that I actually heard that I thought was really laughable was that because wages have to move, like, you know, so wages are sticky, right? Holtzman actually talks about that in the piece. And I love that his little snippet on that, and I'll hit it in just a second. But literally that because wages are declining in value, they have to constantly move. And I literally read in multiple places that the argument was that because wages have to move regularly, that there is high wage mobility, that therefore productive workers have a greater number of opportunities to get paid more. So everyone having to chase the same value every year, everyone having their wage, the value of their wage chipped away, is good because productive workers might have a couple more opportunities to request a higher wage, because they have to request a higher wage because otherwise they get a pay decrease. That is the most laughable backwards excuse for stealing money from people I've ever heard. But I love Hörg Guido Holzman's a little quote on this, which I was just like, so perfect. Wages are sticky only to the extent that workers choose not to work. So the crucial question is, how long can they afford not to work? Beautiful. Just beautiful. The only reason wages are sticky in a high debt, high inflationary environment, wages are not sticky in a high savings, low debt environment. Because in a low debt, high savings environment, people can afford to say, fuck you for not paying me enough. Like, you can just walk away and take a couple of weeks and find a new job because you have savings to fall back on. As soon as, you know, the average worker runs out of savings, well, then he's just gonna look for any possible job that he can get a hold of, and he's going to do it at whatever wage rate that he can manage. And again, people respond to what they are rewarded for doing and or punished for doing. So a inflationary economy that punishes savings and takes away the interest rate for savings, takes away the value of your savings over time. I mean, think about it. Those are the only two rewards for savings, is to have the same value or more of it after 2 years of savings, or to get paid an interest rate for savings, for not consuming resources when you could consume resources. What you're doing is you're leaving resources available for everybody else in the economy who may need it more desperately than you. You can afford to put a little away. If you don't get either of those two things, why the hell would you be saving? And when at the same time your debts are declining in value and somebody's offering you 0% for 6 months, when the prices of all the debt is being highly artificially pushed low, why wouldn't you finance your project with a loan or consume on debt as opposed to savings that are just going to be gone if you hold it? Like, why would you hold it for any length of time? Why wouldn't you just use up all of your resources really as quickly as you can? So what you end up in is a situation where, and these incentives are compounding, you know, like this isn't just a something where like, oh, it might have a couple more people who take on debts, or it might deflation might lead to a couple more people's savings. No, this is incentives across the entire environment. It changes what people think as they grow up. People only think what their social group thinks. Like, if you raise a kid in some, I don't know, a tribe in some third world nation or whatever that has some very specific customs, they will grow up thinking those customs are very important, and that whatever values that social group values are the most important things to care about. And what they believe is what they believe. And if you grow that same kid up in, you know, rural America, or in a city in America, or in a very old traditionalist city in, you know, Europe or something, like they will be different people and have different values based on where they grew up. We are a product of our environment, and it has massive cultural and social implications across the board. Like, if you ask, I mean, go just think about like your grandparents' world versus your world. Like, you would never, ever have been able to buy a house with zero down in the 50s. And you know what else? It also didn't cost you your entire life's work to buy a house. Like, it's a completely different set of incentives. People save. My grandparents save to a degree that looks ridiculous. He saves cups. He saves cups from like fast food places until they don't hold water anymore. It doesn't make any sense. But it was a big part of the culture. It was how a lot of people grew up, and it was because of the economic incentives. It produces different people, it produces different habits, it produces different ways of thinking, and everything, like Ron Paul says, money is one half of every transaction that you ever do in your entire life. And when you start manipulating that, you mold people in just the way that's perfect to create exactly what you want. You chip away at them every day, every transaction. It's something that's just constantly there. And they start to realize the trade-offs. They start to realize what rewarded them and what didn't. When I have dollar savings in my bank account, I had a couple thousand dollars in my savings account. And I remember I laughed out loud because I actually had it in there long enough to get a return, to get an interest payment. And it was like 27 cent or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but genuinely the piece of paper they were sending to me was worth more than what they were telling me I made in interest. And I thought I was going to die. I just laughed so hard because all I could think, all of this went through my head. I was just like, these are the incentives in our economy. This is what people think is going to. People think we have problems with debt. People think we have problems with like a bad culture and people completely losing touch with reality and the actual cost of things. And then the only person that I know that has any savings, and this is the reward. This is the payout, and people think that this is going to be fixed. So it's just such a that key moment of just like everything falls in line and you're like, we're begging for all of these problems, just begging for them. We could not work harder to produce them. So it's just crazy. But what it ends up meaning, like when we talk about these huge cultural shifts, and inflation, when inflation starts pushing people into debt, when it starts making 0% financing like the norm, and every single person that buys a house is doing it with tiny percentage downs just to prop up the price of housing. Absolutely insane. But when debt becomes a part of everything, when the average person just doesn't have savings, you create a trap. You create a society where people cannot leave their jobs. Oh my God, this all started with the whole sticky wages thing. That you can't. Those people are stuck there without savings. They will never be able to leave their job. They get stuck in meaningless jobs that they hate for exorbitant amounts of time because they can never make any headway with savings. And anytime they do start saving, their value is chipped away. And everything that they buy, they're paying 150% of the price to pay it off. And getting artificially low prices for using up other people's resources. So it traps. It creates this massive buffer against mobility. It halts social mobility. And at the direct benefit of the money manipulators, the people who are able to make all of these loans and print all of this money out of thin air, these people are getting enormously wealthy. And at the same time, everybody who is getting trapped into debt, the middle and lower classes, are just getting stuck. While a society that incentivizes deflation, a society of sound money or a period of deflation will incentivize and reward savings massively. It will pay high interest rates to savers, particularly if we're talking about sound money, where to take out a loan, you actually have to have savings. Well, then the interest rate that, you know, that 23% interest rate on your credit card, a large portion of that should be going to anyone who has a savings account, because that is supposed to be the resources that they're swiping with the credit card. You're supposed to lock your money up and you have a one-to-one. You can't loan something out that you don't have. For the same reason I can't loan a car that doesn't exist. So, because that sort of an environment, a deflationary both price and a money supply situation, rewards savings, well, that provides leverage for employees. They could easily walk away from a job that's mistreating them or is dissatisfying to them, whereas an inflationary environment traps them in it and gives them no leverage and basically puts them entirely in the dependency that they're genuinely just kind of subservient to whoever is willing to pay them at the time, and they have to do everything because they're going to have a debt. They're going to have a bill. Every month, if they don't have money coming in, they're screwed. They're going to dig themselves into a hole. I mean, imagine 2 months of not paying any of your debts. Holy crap. Like, you would get, not only would you accrue the interest, but you get late charges because you didn't pay. And those are usually, like, I mean, the amount of money that you would owe in a very short amount of time would be hilariously, like you would have to laugh just to not cry. And I've been there. I have been there before. So I know exactly what it's like to laugh because I didn't want to cry. I have missed bills on credit cards when I did not have any money to my name and no income coming in. And it is an awful, awful thing to have to deal with. And it takes years, years and years to correct for a bad month or two. Holy crap, it is hot in this blanky fort today. I don't know if I'm getting riled up or if it's because I'm drinking a little bit, but I have got to take a break. I'm sweating in here with my screen. All right, that's gross. Okay, let me air this thing out a little bit and get a drink, and we'll hit our sponsor real quick. So, the difference between an inflationary and deflationary, like, incentive structure, like what each one of them produces, on an individual level, when we're talking about wages, an inflationary system puts the employee in a system of, or in a position of weakness and dependency. It means that they are constantly having to fight, and they are in the position of responsibility to go to the employer and fight for a higher wage. And if they do nothing, well, then they get paid less and their value is stolen from them. Whereas in a deflationary environment, you have the exact opposite. They're in a position of power where now it's on the employer to come to them to try to figure out to negotiate a decrease in the wage. And if the employee does nothing, they continue to get paid more and more. They increase in value. So you've got a completely different set of scenarios there. Then they're in a position of weakness in the inflationary environment. Again, they're less likely to have savings, much more likely to have lots of debt in which they cannot afford to fight for a wage and then not get it. So now they have, the cost and the barrier to increase their wage and fight for what would actually be their value looks much more painful because the costs are higher if it screws up. In deflation, you have the exact opposite. They are more likely to have savings and very little debt because there is no incentive that people are paying them to save. They're getting paid an interest rate. So obviously you would do that. And interest rates are very high because credit isn't free and cheap and just thrown around, like it doesn't fund everything. So now they have the power to, if their employer does something they aren't happy with, or if they find they're not satisfied with their occupation, they have far more openness to just fall back on their savings and make a different decision in their life. And think about this at a societal level. Like, this is just kind of like a basic individual idea. When we're talking about across a whole society, you're talking about really the same two, like those two different scenarios applying to everyone to some degree. A society that is deeply in debt, where one person's value, like the value of one person's asset, is actually dependent on someone else paying back their debt. You have counterparty risk spread throughout the entire economy, and you create an entire society that is frail and volatile. One that is something as simple as a hurricane can cause an economic catastrophe that would take years to recover from instead of just merely weeks or months. If you have no savings in the economy to fall back on, well, then you have no buffer. You have no capacitor to sort out the volatility of the real world, the volatility of the weather, the volatility of available resources, the volatility of seasons. You know, you can only grow stuff in the spring and summer, not the winter. Like, the environment and the world is very volatile. The economy is there to create a buffer, a capacitor to level out all of that incredible volatility. And a society that is incentivized to go into debt, that is incentivized not to save, that is punished for savings, and where stored value is confiscated from the people who are actually producing and given to the people who are needlessly and frivolously consuming and trying to just take power and purchasing power and resources for their own ends, whether they're productive or not. That's a weak society. That is one that is always standing on the edge of disaster. But a society that incentivizes savings, one where price levels fall, where you have sound money, is one that's strong because it has savings. It can weather a storm with hardly any significant downturn. It can quickly recover from these things. It's the equivalent of having a backup jetty at the in Katrina, in New Orleans. Like, not only did we not have a sufficient one, but that's kind of what it's like. It's savings is having multiple just in case one fails, and being in debt and always living on the edge is like having a very weak one that's not kept up very well. Well, you could clearly see what the consequences of the two different alternatives would be. So, you create wholly different, the economic product of just the simple difference between a sound money and a constantly inflated away money. And this is, again, this is before we even get to all the ethical nightmares of some political power basically having free command to put resources, to confiscate everybody's resources for whatever mission or goal they see fit, or to implement their vision of the world onto all the people who are actually producing all the resources and making the world, like making all the stuff. But even before we get to there, a one where the money supply is constantly being increased has awful incentives, just awful incentives. And we even know, when we talk about, you hear that silly excuse that it encourages spending. Well, thanks to Simon Lutz's piece on the Keynesian errors in time and demand, we know that all that does is encourage people to spend today rather than spend in a year from now. It just encourages people to waste all their savings or all their resources and not save. And it all the money goes into like low order consumer goods rather than higher order production goods where it would have gone. So you have, and that's the kind of thing that gets you like cheap plastic crap that gets people spending frivolously for no reason because there's no incentive to do anything else with your money. And all the resources that could have gone to growing the economy and making us more productive and more efficient by spending those resources on better production processes, on creating a new and better product to make available is instead it's dumped into rushing out the current product to market. It's used for frivolous and short-lived consumer goods and for cheap, like fast production, low lifespan products. So you lose your, remember, we all have scarce resources. We can only use it for one thing or the other. You're pulling resources from the bettering of the production process and the investments in higher order goods and in better efficient systems. You're pulling the resources away from those missions, from those goals, and you're pushing it into consumer goods and creating consumerism, incentivizing more debt, and creating bloating the market for current consumer goods that is completely unnecessary, encouraging people to spend stuff so that they just don't have it later. So the idea that it's boosting the economy is just an illusion. It's just a temporary spending boost where we won't realize that our production processes are stagnating and that the actual economic growth is being halted and slowed down because, you know, it won't be for 2 years before we realize, like, why is this production process not any better? Why have we not, made any improvements to this? It's incredibly difficult to see that cost because it's slow, it's over time, and the benefits are very easy to point to. Look, we sold twice as many cheap crap things that we thought we were going to sell. Very easy. And Holzman talks about that too, about how the benefits of inflation are easy to see, whereas the benefits of deflation are hard to see. And the costs and incredible disadvantages, the consequences, the negative consequences of inflation are really hard to see. And the benefits of deflation are also hard to see. So you have this like kind of this kind of perfect scenario to make it incredibly easy for people to believe something that's entirely not true, because it's just easier to point to something that you can see rather than explain to somebody something that is incredibly hard to correlate. That's time. Separated by time and separated by the actual people who were involved, like where those costs are. Oh, that reminds me. There's actually a really good book kind of about that very idea because it's kind of like stage one, you know, like being able to think about things very at the high level surface. And Thomas Sowell has a book. You should read all of his books. But this just reminds me of... something economics. Applied economics, thinking beyond stage one. And it's all about how, like, okay, well, this might be the direct immediate consequence of inflation. It's like, okay, more spending right here, but where does that spending come from? What is that spending at the expense of? And kind of the same thing of like kind of the broken window fallacy, the idea that you could literally break somebody's window and then you've created economic production because they had to spend savings. Well, no, it means that somebody has to work a lot to get back to their old standard of living. Like, you've just destroyed something in their life. Like you could just as easily say it's like, oh, well, if we just bomb downtown, like if that principle is true, we could just bomb downtown and then we'd be infinitely rich if that was actually what it meant to be wealthy, was to just be busy doing something. It's absurd when you think beyond stage one, but that's a really good book. If anybody has not, does not know of that book, it's Applied Economics, Thinking Beyond Stage One by Thomas Sowell. So let's go ahead and get into, Let's wrap this up a little bit and talk about how this is going to, what do I mean when I say Bitcoin is going to end the state or bring down the state? And I mean it kind of in the sense of what the set of elites are in today's society. Who is it that's actually running the economy? Who is directing the majority of the resources toward what ends? And, you know, I think I want to start this off just by reading the conclusion again from Haruhito Holzman from Deflation and Liberty, because I really love that last section, and it's only a page. In conclusion, let us restate the main points. Deflation is far from being inherently bad. Quite to the contrary, it fulfills the very important social function of cleansing the economy and the body politic from all sorts of parasites that have thrived on the previous inflation. In a word, the dangers of deflation are chimerical, but its charms are very real. There's absolutely no reason to be concerned about the economic effects of deflation, unless one equates the welfare of the nation with the welfare of its false elites. There are, by contrast, many reasons to be concerned about both the economic and political consequences of the only alternative to deflation, namely reinflation, which is, of course, nothing but inflation, pure and simple. The purpose of these pages is not to appeal to the reason of our monetary authorities. There is absolutely no hope that the Federal Reserve or any other fiat money producer of the world will change their policies anytime soon. But it is time that the Friends of Liberty change their minds on the crucial issue of deflation. False thinking on this point has given our governments undue leeway, of which they have made ample and bad use. Ultimately, we need to take control over the money supply out of the hands of our governments and make the production of money again subject to the principle of free association. The first step to endorsing and promoting this strategy is to realize that governments do not, indeed cannot, fulfill any positive role whatever through the control of our money. So when I say the state, in this instance, I don't mean it specifically as like the state, just the general institution, which it may. I'm not discounting the fact that that is a possibility simply because Bitcoin changes the nature of the payoff and risks associated. It's the payoff, the visibility, and the risks associated with using violence to confiscate resources, and the inability to do it through inflation and having to do it through direct taxation is going to change the nature of government in a massive, massive way. What we have known of as the state and the degree of government power over society and moving funds and resources to their ends rather than ours in the last 100, 120, 30 years or so is going to change drastically. Like that idea of that level of state institution, I do not think is possible in a world where something like Bitcoin is the dominant monetary instrument. So I'm not meaning that the state will just vanish as an institution any more than I think science would make the church vanish. Like, but it takes away the power. It makes it more of a figurehead and some degree of a voluntary institution. It takes away its teeth. And I think Bitcoin, I think just in the nature of deflation and how it works, as it becomes a dominant form of, as it becomes the dominant monetary good, like it stops, it will stop inflation from being possible. It will start, it will prevent them from being able to use their political position and they're a printing press, essentially, to hide the fact that they're confiscating resources. And that will make it much like right now, like when people are like, oh my God, housing is so much more expensive, rent so much higher, healthcare is so much higher. Well, they get pissed at each other when it you have to. But that's because of the trillions of dollars confiscated from the economy, those resources, and the immense amount of inflation that's happening behind the scenes that they don't see. But when you have to send it, you literally have to pull the money from people's accounts or directly tax to get that actual purchasing power available, that you no longer have a monetary authority. I mean, in a world with Bitcoin, there is no such thing as a monetary authority that has anything that is of any consequence. The idea of banks being the largest buildings in the city, like the tallest buildings, a banking license comes with no privilege to produce your own money anymore. You cannot issue debts. Like, you may be able to run a short term fractional reserve, but you're just going to end up like MT Gox. That's what Mt. Gox did. It was fractional reserve. They didn't have enough money to cover everybody's withdrawals. Like, you can't do that systemically. You can't do that society wide. And it is a fraud. It's a ripoff, no matter how you do it. So it's the only reason like we have this political institution and this system that we have now is because they get to hide the fact that they're being completely fraudulent. It becomes very difficult to see, and they justify it because they decide what we'd learn in school. It's really kind of insane. And it will be the end of central banks. Central banks will not be, even if they are still there and they have their own currencies, it will be because they hold Bitcoin and gold to actually back their currencies, but it will call all of their debts due. They will no longer be able to just loan themselves and anybody else as much money as they want. There will be a massive barrier to doing that. Any decision that they have will have immediate consequences, and those immediate consequences will be in the loss of their purchasing power to do anything, and then the loss of trust that they're holding any real value to have a safe currency. Like Bitcoin will be that resistance. It will be there in every boardroom, in every committee, and in like every every central bank board. They will not be able to make decisions without accounting for the fact that this is what it will mean. This is what people will do, like push into Bitcoin or into real money instead of ours. They lose all of their power. And with that, you fix all of the massive misallocations. Now, don't get me wrong. The transition is going to be rough. The transition is going to be crap. People are going to, like, my house is probably not going to be worth a third of what I paid for it after this collapse. I kind of bought a house knowing that that was probably going to be the case after this, you know, next collapse happens, unless they, of course, like, inflate to the winds, and yeah, there's no telling. But if we had a large credit crisis, I sat and I said, okay, if this happened, can I live with that? Is that okay? So my luck would be that they continue to inflate the currency away, and they steal the money from all of the producers of society and devalue my mortgage on this house. And that's probably what they'll do until they don't have any choice. But in the short run, it will probably be a deflationary credit spiral where the actual supply of money is getting cut because of defaults, et cetera, et cetera. So having a deflationary currency, having a sound money that puts a check on all of that power, will destroy the institutions that only survive because of inflation. It eliminates the entire advantage that being able to obtain inflation-based debt, like the whole financing world that profits off overinflated stock prices and asset prices and gets inflation-based debt at incredibly cheap rates before everyone else in the economy. Got to remember, that's another thing, is that this is one of the many ways that they have even more power, is that whoever gets the money first is able to pay the higher prices, even at credit or the printing press, whatever it is. Whoever gets the money first, and even worse, at a lower interest rate than they offer it and loan it out to other people to, they get it first, and now they can afford the higher wages. They can afford the better workers. They can afford the resources before the prices go up. And now everybody else in the economy, all the producers and the middle class and the poor, that are working their butts off to keep all of this stuff alive, now sees the prices of all their goods being bid up, the price of gas going up, the price of healthcare going up, the price of all these assets going up, their rent is going up, and they don't get the money until you know, 10, 20 steps down the line when they're finally getting paid and all the price is already high. So the banks and the financial world that gets these gets this money, the closer you are politically or economically to the printing press, the more power you have. It's the entire thing revolves, all the power revolves around how close you are to the ability to get the money for nothing. And all of that genuinely breaks away in a world with Bitcoin. And it does so without even attempting, or not even instituting, reinstituting a free market. Bitcoin has made money this weird social good that no one owns. And I mean, it does, that's kind of the thing about Bitcoin, is that it is entirely based upon voluntary association. Like, you can't force anybody to use Bitcoin. And so it is essentially a free market in money, but it's no longer the free market as Herg Guido Holzman was talking about it in the Freedom to Mint and Issue Paper Substitutes for Gold. We have an entirely different environment where Bitcoin is this collectively managed monetary policy that it's fascinating. And it is going to completely flip. I think people discount how much of government and banking and like financial power comes from just that one differentiator. It's not taxes. Taxes obviously are the government has the ridiculous moral exception that they can take from someone and it's morally okay, and if I take from someone, well, it's morally terrible, like it's bad. They get that bizarre religious exception to the what is a universal truth. They get to actually hurt people for good reasons, and that won't really go away. That will still be there, but taxes are not where they get the most of their power. Their power is in debt with no cap, in deficits that can just run wild, the ability to bail out any institution that they want to keep running, and to essentially buy you. The Federal Reserve is buying assets. Think about that. The Federal Reserve is buying things from the actual economy, actual stock, propping up all of these prices. They've purchased loans. And I mean, it's insane. They are literally soaking up. They own all of these assets in an quote-unquote altruistic effort to fix the world. We're going to own everything in order to make everything better. How ridiculous is that? But most of the power, most of the redistribution of resources is in the fractional reserve system, where loans are being created constantly just within financial institutions, and like they have the right to do it just themselves, and then in the ability to run up debts as far as they want to at the government and central banking level, and by extension, deficits. You could just, like, it doesn't matter how much you bring in, just spend whatever you feel like you need to spend. And, you know, as long as we say it's for jobs or need jobs, well, then, you know, it's great. You know, no big deal. We'll just invent money out of thin air. And of course, it will grow the economy and everything will be wonderful and it'll be great. Bitcoin is a cap on all of that power. All of it. It ruins the advantage and the ability to actually maintain fractional reserve. It destroys the ability to just make whatever decision at the Federal Reserve that they want, because it has immediate effects, because there's a quick and instant escape valve that they cannot control. It makes individuals more self-reliant. It will incentivize savings again. We'll have a robust economy. People will invest in long-term projects. HODL will be a cultural, nationwide, global phenomenon. And it will be it's the proof of the cultural effects of savings on a hard money asset. Granted, we are obviously in the monetization stage of things, but it will essentially always be like that. And this is just kind of an exaggerated version of the incentives, just because it's being monetized. So you're seeing exponentially greater growth than you would actually see in like a market saturated environment. But by 2028, Bitcoin's going to be the hardest money, the most sound, most disinflationary money that has ever existed, ever. And it's completely open. You can essay it, you know, A-S-S-A-Y. You can verify what it is and that you're using real money. Every time you make a transaction, no big deal. I just can't believe that people don't see, that's not true. I can't believe it, but it's upsetting to me how powerful of a tool and a technology this is and that people don't get it. That's why I'm here doing this show, is because I want to share it out. You know, I want people to understand exactly what we're dealing with here. This is on the level of centuries and centuries as far as the amount of change this is going to bring to how we organize and cooperate as a society. And I don't think, I really don't think you can overstate it, because I think inevitably you miss second, third, and fourth level changes that you just wouldn't think of. You know, again, with the thinking beyond stage one, it's very hard to, you know, sometimes it's really easy to, like, obviously you have the first effects and then the second layer effects, but there's third, fourth, fifth layer, like it continues to compound again and again, the number of changes and the amount of change that is going to come as a result of this, I think, is really, really, really hard to overstate. This all obviously on the hinges on the fact that Bitcoin continues to be successful and continues to be resistant to governments and resistant to the ability to inflate its currency away, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think that's hard to. I think we're past the point of no return. I don't think we can go back. And as much as the transition will inevitably be painful, it's the funny thing is it's not really Bitcoin that's forcing the pain. When you think about it, the financial system is destroying itself. The financial system has committed suicide. Like, there's no way for these debts. Like, there was going to be deflation one way or the other. It's actually kind of a miracle that we have an escape valve to so that we do not expose ourselves to it, so that we're not completely trapped in paying the consequences of their fraud and their misallocation and their massive misallocation of resources. Somebody has to pay the price. It should be them. Bitcoin makes it so that it can be them, as long as, you know, we use that as our escape valve. All right. I think we'll start wrapping this up. The only other thing I wanted to say, which I didn't want to dwell on a whole lot, just because I think it's silly, but I guess it's important to address when they talk about, like, the deflationary spirals, how everybody will hoard money. Hoarding money doesn't take resources away from anybody. Money is not a consumable resource. If you hoard money and it creates a price level deflation, well, it just means that stuff gets cheaper for other people, so they need less money to obtain it. Like, again, money's just a proxy for actual resources. So if you withdraw money from the economy, you're not actually taking resources from other people. You're leaving resources available. You're putting resources into the economy because you produced, and then holding the money in its place as a promise that you'll be able to get those resources back in the future. But all you've done is made resources available to other people. So it's literally the exact opposite. It's not a case where people are hoarding money and therefore others cannot afford stuff because they don't have the money. It's people are hoarding money, therefore the prices and availability of all the other goods are higher. The prices are all lower because the availability of all those goods are higher because they are hoarding money, therefore everyone can afford stuff. So it's the exact opposite. If you had incredibly high savings rate, I mean, look at all the prices today. Everything's fueled by debt and spending. All prices are going up, right? Well, you'd have the exact opposite if everybody was saving and you didn't have constant increases of the money supply. well, then, you know, things would become more affordable. Like, so to argue that hoarding money would make resources less, make it harder for people to afford things, would be to argue that all this debt and spending and everything is making things more affordable for everyone. And that's not the case. Ask anybody if healthcare is more or less affordable than it was 20 years ago, housing 20 years ago, education, anything. And then the other one that I consider hilariously absurd is that a deflationary spiral would mean people just hold on to money and they never spend it on anything. Well, you've got a. Why is that? Why would people do that? Because they want to hold money because they think it's going to go up in value, right? Because they want to hold value that does not decrease or does not go away. And they want their future to be better than the present. They're doing it to make their lives better. So when you say inflation will keep people from doing that, like obviously it's not going to change people's tendency to want to hold something that keeps its value and to want them to make their lives better in the future. Like that's not going to go away. It's not going to change what they are trying to do and what they want to do with their value. They just won't do it with money anymore. They'll do it with actual resources and commodities and assets, which means it will be taking real resources away from other people. When they're holding money, they're leaving those resources for other people. They're hoarding money and, again, making those resources available. If you're not hoarding money, well, then now you're hoarding assets. Now you have the situation like Connor Brown's article that we read. Bitcoin has no utility. And that's great. It's named something like that. I'll try to remember to put that one in the show notes too. That article, he talks about how like now real estate and land is the number one place for the wealthy to park their money. And that it was something like, I can't remember the exact percentage, but it's something like 30% of luxury homes in some area, I think it was in like California or something, sit empty for the vast majority of the year because wealthy people are just parking their money there so that it does not lose value. They're soaking up all the supply of housing, increasing the price of housing, and making it harder for poor people and middle class people to live because they're buying up all the actual assets. They're buying up all the houses that they don't need to live in. They've got plenty of houses already. They're just soaking it all up because they can't park their wealth in money. It will lose all of its value. So, again, it's the exact opposite is what they claim. And then also just the silliness that, oh, people will just hold money forever and then never spend it. Well, the only reason you hold money is so that you can consume. Money is pointless, and like it's like saying, like you only use it like, oh God. Okay, easy example. You know what happens when people start holding money and the price goes up exponentially? Well, people start spending it because they got wealthy and because the whole purpose of actually holding an asset that increases in value is to then use that value at a later date and then it crashes. You know how we know that that's how it happens? You know how we know that it does not last forever, no matter how scarce the monetary good is? Well, because it's happened like six times in Bitcoin. Happens all the time. So we know exactly how that ends. It's not infinite. It just goes through cycles. And those will start to ease out. They will level out and become less volatile as it continues in the future. It already has. If you see like the three or four major bubbles that have happened, you put them on a volatility chart and they're less volatile. It just as the economy becomes more liquid, that's going to become less and less of an issue. And we already know it doesn't last forever. We already know what an economy looks like. We already know that the Bitcoin economy has vast amounts of investment. There is no shortage of capital going around because tons of people have savings to start their own businesses. Tons of Bitcoin OGs who've been in this space for a really long time are starting up businesses and becoming producers because they have savings. Because this economy creates huge incentives to hold your resources for later use in the future, to Leave those resources available to other people and hold your money. And to save, this is a savings technology that fixes the imbalance of the inflationary and the fractional reserve system. The only real problem that the Bitcoin economy has is the fact that people don't buy frivolous crap. If you don't have a real product that's worth something to somebody, nobody's going to buy it from you. Probably the only thing you can get is Lightning stickers that will actually sell. But that's the kind of the thing, is that it just changes incentives. It changes the nature of the economy and priorities. It changes people into a long-term time preference. Talked about many times on the show, the difference between short-term and long-term time preference. And the Bitcoin standard, if you haven't read it, what are you doing? You need to get on that. And I don't know, it's just going to be, we're genuine, this is why I call it a new world. This is why when I close out my show, I call the crypto economy a new economy. I consider it completely at odds with the incentive structure, with the fundamental systemic model of the legacy economy. What we have is fundamentally different here. And it's young. It's still just being born. But you can see where it's going to go. And it's going to change everything. It's going to change culture. It's going to change incentives. It's going to change savings rates. It's going to destroy this debt-based. It's going to make this debt-based system finally destroy itself. It's going to be the catalyst that I think actually allows us a way out of all of this, and which is hard to believe that that's actually available to us. I don't know of any other time in history in which there was a way to possibly shift your way out of the consequences of this type of debt crisis. Not on an economic, like not on a whole society scale. Like this is a global escape valve, essentially. So never to this degree do I know of it ever being possible. Like it'd be a huge historical event, obviously. And I've probably said it a million times, but it's just, I don't think we could be living through a more exciting and more consequential time in history. Like the fact that we are here right now, seeing this happen and seeing this unfold, I think is just extraordinary. Okay, I'm out. I'm tired. It's been a long day. I hope you guys enjoyed this Guy's Take episode where I just ranted all about deflation and inflation and the difference between the two different economies that are at war, in a sense, and the different incentives and what type of people and what type of structure they will produce. And I want to give one more thanks to Mises.org. I hope you guys listened to Deflation and Liberty by Herr Guido Holzmann, because it's amazing, and I loved it. Such a good piece. Lots of great info in that one. And of course, if you haven't and you want to go 300 pages deeper into this, read The Ethics of Money Production. It's extraordinary. It's based on the same theme, the same idea, just taking it to just far deeper than you can imagine. So it's amazing. I'll definitely check that one out. You know, I'll link to that in the show notes too. I'll try to remember. I got like Simon Lutz's Time and Demand, Keynesian Errors article. We've got Deflation and Liberty. Ooh, another really good one is Why Does Fiat Money Exist? That one really has a lot to do with essentially the one good reason why the government definitely would always want control over our money. Wait, is that what it's called? Or why does government control their money? I don't know. I'll figure it out. Check the show notes. I'm going to have a lot of great episodes for follow-ups and deeper diving into this topic. Thank you guys so much for joining me. You're listening to The Crypto Economy, and I am Guy Swan. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and I will catch you back here with another episode. Don't forget, Monday we got the interview with Aaron Van Vertum coming at you. And it's a really, really fun one. I think you all are going to enjoy it. So I will catch you back here then. Don't forget to subscribe. Share this out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. and follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. And until then, take it easy, guys.